In this first hour of the show, we will look back at the Wall Street boom and bust of the 1990s. Our guest for the program will be financial journalist Roger Lowenstein. He's the author of a newly published book, which is titled Origins of the Crash. It's published by the Penguin Press, and it looks at a number of things, including how it is and why it was that greed became so rampant in the 1990s, how America could have believed so blindly in the new economy and the promise of limitless wealth, how fraud could have become so widespread, and also what unfinished business remains to address excesses that continue today. He's the author of two best-selling books. One, it's about the investment guru Warren Buffett, which is titled Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist. Another that looks at the fall of the hedge fund long-term capital management. The title of that book is When Genius Failed. He reported for the Wall Street Journal for more than a decade. He wrote the journal's stock market column, Heard on the Street, from 89 to 91, and the intrinsic value column from 95 to 97. He's now columnist for Smart Money magazine. He also writes for the New York Times magazine and the Wall Street Journal, among other publications. Right now, he is spending some time traveling around the country talking about the book, and today he is in Chicago. Your questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. All we ask from callers is that people just are brief, as they can be, so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone is welcome to call. Mr. Lowenstein, hello.
Hello, Dave.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Appreciate it. I think when you ask this question of, well, what happened to create the bubble and then the bust, there is no single answer. There are a lot of things that came together, and we can talk about each of those things.
You know, right? And you raised an interesting point is, you know, didn't we learn anything?
Mm.
That's asked so often, and particularly when one thinks about the striking similarities between a previous period, meaning the 1920s, in the 90s, you recall, they were ushered in by an event I think that people overlook, at least overlook the economic significance of it. That was the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Hmm. And people began to talk about the end of history. And I think most Americans believe that political and foreign policy concerns were a thing of the past, and we were sort of in an era of permanent peace and prosperity. It's very interesting, in the 20s, of course, World War One had just ended, and that was known as the war to end all wars. They also believed they were in an era of unending peace. They had new technologies then, such as radio and mass production. In fact, they even had a slogan, the new era, it was called, uncannily an echo of our own new economy. So, you know, the resonance of the two periods is a little disconcerting.
Hmm. You know, one of the things that I think is really striking that happened over this period is the increase in the number of people who were invested in stocks. In the 60s, it was something like a fifth of Americans, and by the mid-90s, it was almost half. And even today, you know, you have people, still investment advisors are saying everybody should be in the stock market. And I guess I wonder if you think maybe that kind of thinking was wrong.
Well, I think, you know, medicine is always good, but medicine always has side effects. And you have to remember how distant the stock market was from the ordinary person's life in the 70s. There was usually a single account in the daily newspaper about Wall Street. Maybe a half a sentence on the radio or television broadcast, that was it. Of course, there was no internet. People would go to the mailbox to get find out how they did in their mutual funds. You know, they'd wait, you know. I mean, every 3 months they'd get a letter, and that would tell them. That'd be all they thought about it till the next quarter was over. Today we're suffused in investing programs, financial advice, financial literature, and the buzz of one sort or another. To some extent, that makes us more informed, but I also think it has made us jumpier and maybe less patient and intelligent in what we do. And, you know, a particular thought when I said that, you know, medicine has side effects, the introduction of 401ks made every American the master of his or her own portfolio.
Uh-huh.
You know, that wasn't true a generation ago. That may be a good thing, but if you're investing for your retirement, there's no reason why you should be shifting in and out of stocks or funds every other week or every other month. Mm. And if people wanted to design a 401k program that would truly fulfill the ends, which is to help people in their retirements, they might think about withdrawing the tax advantages, except for people who don't trade. Why should someone investing until the year, for the year 2030, be pulling in and out of every hot stock? And I think it wasn't the fact that they were investing, but it was the fact that they were trading and getting caught up in that hot stock mentality.
So
that
you're
got
drawing
people into trouble.
You're drawing a distinction between investing and speculating.
I draw a very big distinction between that.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, right? One of the things you discuss right on the very first page is the notion that now it seems to be kind of an article of faith among Republicans, and that is that people should be able to take some of the money that is going into Social Security and put that into stocks.
Yes.
And you talk about,
can you imagine what would have happened in 1999?
Yeah.
What percentage of Social Security funds would have been invested in Yahoo and AOL and companies that no longer exist, for that matter? I think it's enough that that our private retirement accounts are investable in stocks to take what is the bedrock security for our future. You know, the things that potentially will keep some senior citizens off bread lines, and to let people speculate with them. I think could lead to a potentially a social crisis. I mean, I just if anything proved the insanity of that idea, I think it was the late 90s.
Yeah, that's also, I think, an illustration of how people's thinking have changed. As you note that back in the 70s, Ronald Reagan, when he was running for president, said he thought this would be a good idea, and the incumbent president, who happened to be a Republican, Gerald Ford, said it was ridiculous.
That's right. And it's sort of ironic. This is in 76 when Reagan challenged Ford for the Republican nomination and lost, although, of course, came back and was elected himself in 1980. The ironic thing is that in the mid-70s, it might have been an okay idea. The 70s were a terrible period for stocks. The Dow Jones average in 1979 was only around 700, which was only twice what it was in 1929, 50 years earlier. I mean, think about that's something like a 1% gain a year over 50 years compounded. So, at least Reagan was advocating it when stocks were cheap.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Roger Lowenstein. He's a financial journalist. He has written for the Wall Street Journal, worked for the journal for a number of years. He's now a columnist for Smart Money magazine and continues to write for the journal and also the New York Times, and is the author of a newly published book entitled Origins of the Crash, the Great Bubble and Its Undoing, published by the Penguin Press, looking at the great stock boom and bust of the 90s. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You suggest in the book that if we're really going to understand what happened in the 90s, we have to look back to a previous decade and
right.
Look back to the 80s, 70s and 80s, and what was going on when we had the first wave of merger mania.
That's right. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. But the 70s, as I said, was this terribly depressed period. We were, as a country, I think, depressed about our ability to compete. Sounds a little familiar, I think, today. But the Japanese companies in particular seemed to be stealing a march on American companies. And the stock market had gone nowhere for many, many years. And suddenly, takeover artists came along, and they began to bid up share prices. And that got people's attention. It really did get the country and companies moving again, because CEOs began to say, I got to get my stock price up. Now, this, of course, they'd always been interested in getting their stocks going in the long term, but suddenly they couldn't wait to the long term because, in the long term, their company might be owned by Henry Kravis or Boone Pickens or, one of these takeover guys. So CEOs became very focused in an immediate sense on their share price. And then boards of directors began to do things to reinforce that. Of course, the main thing they did was to give them stock options. And now you're going to say, so what's bad about that? In the first instance, it was a good thing. CEOs I think, were re-energized, and they did feel a commitment to work for their shareholders. Over time, I think the message got distorted. You know, it's one thing to work very hard to get your company growing so that the stock rises. It's something very different to say, I'm going to do whatever I can to get the stock up in the short term, mm-hmm. and regardless of the performance. And as executives began to get more and more options, which, by the way, vested over very short-term periods, they really began to forget about performance and just pay attention to, you know, what can I do to get the stock up? And often that meant manipulating the earnings and manipulating the disclosure. And, you know, that's why we had not just Enron, but hundreds of companies having to restate their earnings every year over the last few years.
Yeah. And that was, I think it's an important point probably for people to understand that not only was that a pervasive idea in corporate boardrooms, but people in business schools had the same idea that they said, well, you know, it's we need to have corporate executives' compensation linked directly to the company's performance. Otherwise, the execs will have no incentive for the company to do well. That might have been a good idea at the start, but ultimately it wasn't.
The business schools in particular, University of Chicago and Harvard, were, you know, four square behind this idea. And they really overlooked something. The people like Michael Jensen, who was a famous professor now emeritus at the Harvard Business School, and who wrote a paper that had a great impact on boards, urging them to give more options. What he said is, look, we don't want executives to be like these old feudal lord types that don't care about their stockholders. We want to make them think like shareholders. That's fine. So to make them think like owners, they have to become owners and give them options. What the academics and the compensation consultants overlooked is that an executive with an option doesn't have the same equation as you or I when we buy stock. If you or I buy stock, we have a potential gain, but we also have a potential loss. Okay? The executive with an option, for him, it's a one-way street. He has a potential gain, but he risks nothing. That makes it very different. When boards then began to give executive options year after year after year, these executives are like guys at a roulette table with someone saying, gamble all you want because we'll give you a fresh stack of chips on the next spin and the next spin and the next spin until you finally hit. So we really gave them an incentive to gamble. And it's no coincidence that in, say, an industry like telecommunications where option granting was by far the largest, people like Bernie Ebbers, that was also the industry where the most money was wasted on overinvestment because the CEOs knew that if they invested their shareholders' capital, the downside was the shareholders would lose money, but the upside was the executives could make money. Mm. And that was a terribly perverse incentive.
Well, there's another piece here. Now, while this, what happened here, it was in the interest of the executives who had either as part of their compensation were given a lot of stock or stock options. It was their interest to do anything that they could to drive up the price. However, something also was going on the shareholder side. There was in tremendous and increasing pressure to, over a short period of time, increase the value of the stock. And what happened was that it seems to the exclusion of anything else, the stock price was taken as an indication of the health and the success of the company.
That's right. You know, there's an old story about the guy who goes in for surgery, and he comes out and he says to the doctor, how'd I do? And the doc says, not so good. So the patient thinks for a second, and he says, well, could you at least touch up the x-rays so I look better? And, you know, really we developed in the 90s a financial culture that bought into the idea of touching up companies' financial x-rays, you know, when those companies really deserve to be in the recovery room. And it was very broad. It wasn't just a number, you know, a few greedy executives. If you think about when Enron first got into trouble, serious trouble, it was when Andy Fastow had this idea of creating partnerships that he would run and that would trade with Enron, with the shareholders that he was a fiduciary for. And the only trouble was that Enron had this pesky thing called the conflict of interest policy. So Andy went to the board, and they said, no problem, we'll waive it. Well, you know, the board is supposed to be the gatekeeper, the group looking out for shareholders. Then Enron wanted to borrow money but didn't want it to look like it was borrowing money. So I went to J.P. Morgan, and J.P. Morgan said, no problem. You can sell us some gas, and then we'll buy it back from you at a little higher price. Well, guess what? There's no real gas. It doesn't move any place. Money goes to Enron, and then a little more money goes back. That's called a loan. But J.P. Morgan has dressed it up in a way so that they don't have to report it as a loan. They were helping Enron enhance the appearance of its business, helping it enhance their financial x-ray, not the business itself. And I think the whole community lost sight of that distinction.
That, again, now here gets us into another question, that there were a number of parties, boards of directors, the firms that were doing the accounting for the corporations, and all of those various government entities that were supposed to be doing financial oversight of corporations, a whole bunch of people dropped the ball. Where were the people that were supposed to be regulating the corporations and ultimately looking out for the interest of shareholders and then again, at the end of the day, employees of these companies?
Well, I think too many of them had read Michael Jensen and got otherwise influenced by this culture that I call in the book the culture of shareholder value. Shareholder value, I think, began with the idea that the new CEO of the 80s and 90s was going to be working for his shareholders in the long term. It got corrupted over time to... The term came to be used by CEOs who did anything for their stock price. If you look at Michael Eisner, it's a very interesting case because he came in as a reformer. In fact, Disney was one of the targets of a takeover by Irwin Jacobs in 1984, and that's why they brought Eisner in. And for many years, he achieved very, very good returns. Over time, the luster, the magic wore off, and as it did, Eisner's compensation went up and up and up, so that as shareholders have suffered just an atrocious last decade at Disney, Eisner has reaped over $1 billion. Now, you said, where were the people? The first people who should have been watching the store, of course, were Eisner's board. Well, who was on Eisner's board? The principal of one of his kids' schools, Eisner's personal architect, his personal lawyer, basically everybody... save Mickey Mouse. Of course, Eisner was chairman of the board. So we allowed the imperial CEO, I think, was largely a result of the fact that we allowed boards, who are the first gatekeepers, to be corrupted. Hmm. Now, another important gatekeeper are the auditing firms. They may be the most important, because if you can't trust the company's books, who can you trust? We knew in the 90s that we had a problem. Arthur Levitt, the head of the SEC then, tried desperately to prevent accounting firms who audited companies from also supplying consulting advice to them, because it would create a conflict of interest. Obviously, if a company's giving you tens of millions of dollars as a consultant, you're going to go easier on their audit because you don't want to lose the consulting business. Levitt said, hey, we got a conflict here. The accounting industry ganged up on him, none other than Ken Lay, went to the Congress and said, hey, Arthur Andersen consults with us. They're a great auditor. We don't see the need for any change here. Levitt had to back off. There were a number of instances. The lobbying in the 90s was so strong that regulators had to back off. Of course, Glass-Steagall was repealed, which gave investment banks such as Citigroup and Morgan an incentive to, cover their eyes with clients like WorldCom and Enron, because they also wanted to underwrite stocks and securities and bonds for those companies. That was the conflict at Glass-Steagall, which had separated banks and commercial banks and investment banks from doing. In a number of ways, pressure from lobbyists and from the Republican Congress at the time, the Gingrich Congress, whittled away the gatekeeper function. I'll give you one other very interesting example. When they knifed into the SEC's budget, the SEC had to lengthen the cycle of reviews. In the past, it used to review each public company's books every 3 years. That changed every 6 years, which meant that Enron, which was reviewed in 1997, and would, under the old system, have been reviewed again in the year 2000, got a free pass until 2003, by which time, of course, it was out of business.
Among the things you suggest is that the function of the CEO and the chairman of the board should be separated. That is, it should be two different people. How common is it now that corporate CEOs are also the chairman of their own board?
You know, it's very common, David. If you think how often you hear someone described as chairman and CEO, you don't even think twice about it. And people really should. It's a unique realm in American life where people are their own bosses. I'm not just talking about business. Our society is founded on the idea of checks and balances. President Bush today says he wants to outlaw gay marriages. That's fine, but under our system, he can't do it alone. He's got to get a constitutional amendment, which means Congress and the legislatures will have to approve and so forth. And if Congress wants to do something, it has to go to Bush. And I'm sure you have a producer there who watches what you do, and I have editors at my publisher. We all have checks and balances of one sort or another. But CEOs, uniquely, are chairmen of their own boards. They're the head of the group that is supposed to monitor themselves. And it's a situation that, you know, that just asks for trouble. I mean, and that's what we got in the 90s. If the 90s proved anything, it's that, you know, Jack Welch and Ken Lay and Mike Eisner, were not fit to be their own bosses. And we really need independent board chairmen.
There is yet another piece here, and that is the role in all of this that was played by the business media.
Oh, I knew you were going to get to us. Can I use the term us?
Yes, sir. If you want to claim it.
Yeah, you know, I think the business media drunk a little bit of the Kool-Aid. I think there was, you know, in the electronic media, radio and TV, you know, maybe a little more of it, you know, ringing that bell and CNBC and getting people all juiced up about the day's action. But the newspapers, I think, also got caught up in hot stocks, in, you know, advising people to, say, go into the dot-coms. The newspapers were full of accounts of people like Ryan Jacob, who was an internet wonderkind, you know, 20-something kid with a mutual fund who, you know, ultimately lost 90% of his investors' money. I think, you know, we are also gatekeepers, and some journalists, but too few said, hey, is the emperor here wearing any clothes?
About midway through this part of Focus 580, and again, we certainly will invite questions and comments from people who are listening. Our guest is Roger Lowenstein. He's a financial writer. He has worked for the Wall Street Journal for more than a decade. He also continues to contribute to columns to the Journal and also to the New York Times Magazine. He is columnist for Smart Money Magazine. He's written two books, in addition to the one that we're talking about. One that's about investor Warren Buffett. The other is about the collapse of the long-term capital management hedge fund. His new book is titled Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing, about the stock market boom and bust of the 90s. It's published by the Penguin Press. He's spending some time traveling around the country talking about it and is in Chicago today. Questions here on the show are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, that one good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. When you listen to you talk about this and the way that you lay it out in the book, it fits together, but you know what they say about hindsight. Should we have seen this coming?
You know, Dave, I think many people did see it coming. There were John Kenneth Galbraith, who wrote about the 1929 crash, said, you know, maybe being poor forever was a fair price to pay for just being rich for a little while. And I think there was an element of that in the 90s. I think people did know that stocks were overvalued. If you think how many times somebody said to you, you know, I know this seems crazy, but, you know, my neighbor made a buck on it, or, you know, my brother-in-law's done okay. Most people in the beginning, you know, their first instinct when they saw some flybynight.com go to the moon was to shake their head and say, oh, that's nuts. And it was only when they saw it happening two, three, four times over that they leapt in. I think one lesson is, you know, if something seems irrational to you, you know, as tempting as it is, as hard as it is to resist, you know, follow that instinct of yours that says it's irrational, and don't go in just because your neighbor's in or something. because he's really not any smarter than you. And by the way, this wasn't just a pitfall for small investors. Folks like George Soros invested at the very peak in tech stocks. And he'd been saying it was crazy all along, and then finally he gave up the ghost because he just couldn't bear to see other people getting so rich off him. I think people did know these companies had no earnings and no revenues even in many cases.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation in Urbana, here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Yes, back to this issue of the combined role of executive as CEO and chairman of the board.
Yeah.
I'm just curious as to what you think is the rationale for that. Is it that people feel that to get the caliber of executive they would like, they need to appeal to some power-hungry nature, or is it in order that they might increase their compensation package by giving them two titles, or what? I just don't see any rationale for that.
The rationale, it's a good question. The rationale is that it's always been that way, and CEOs are going to go to their graves kicking and screaming to keep it that way. Historically, we've always had weak boards, and I guess there's a reason for that. After all, most companies used to be private, right? I mean, the DuPonts were owned by the DuPont family, and all companies originated as family companies. So In that era, when companies were private, it didn't much matter if the CEO wanted to fritter away his assets. Well, it was his company, his family.
Right. Okay, I got the impression that this was a more recent phenomenon.
No. But so come the 1920s and 30s, when companies are going public, they agreed to set up boards. The power still rested, largely with this. And it's never been rested away, and particularly as the large families sold off stock, companies have lost their big investors. So that say there are very few companies with a weighty presence on the board, like say Ford Motor still has the Ford family still owns a lot of stock. So when you get a company, as most are owned today by, in this sense, it has increased. When you get a company owned just by millions of teeny shareholders, there's no one investor that has the clout of the CEO. And therefore, the board represents, in effect, a lot of powerless people.
Right.
And it's easy for the directors to forget that they're working. They are representing those individually powerless people.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go next to next person here in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I read recently where the Federal Accounting Standards Board might be passing and saying that options are no longer, they may say that they have to expense them. I thought I'd check up on the status of that if you know anything about it.
Yeah, the Financial Accounting Standards Board is a body in Connecticut that makes rules for how companies account. And this has been a very controversial issue. And the issue is, when companies pay executives in stock options rather than in cash, should they have to account for it, i.e. should they have to deduct the expense from their earnings? And Silicon Valley fought this tooth and nail and stopped it, in the 90s. And they said then and they say now that, well, this will be the death of options, the death of incentives and so on. And, I have to point out, no one is saying outlaw options. They're just saying you recognize them, Don't hide them under a rug. And the,
right.
The FASB, the Standings Board, is studying it, and I believe is committed to making the change. And once again, Silicon Valley is marshaling its troops in Congress. So all I can say is stay tuned.
Very good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And to another caller, this next person is in back here in Urbana, line three. Hello.
Yeah. Hi.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
I know one of the big events back in the late 90s was the Russian debt default that brought down long-term capital management.
That's right.
And the strong dollar policy instituted by Robert Rubin as a response to that. I wondered if you could talk about what that might have had to do with the whole thing.
Well, when Russia, first Russia and then LTCM collapsed, there was really a financial panic. And I think the big thing that grew out of that for the average investor was that Alan Greenspan felt a need to really loosen and infuse some confidence and some capital back into the markets. And so he eased rates three times over. This was in the fall of 98, and the bull market had taken a serious pause or correction going into that. And by the time Greenspan had finished easing, we were really off to the races, and it was only then, but it was immediately thereafter, in late November and December 98, when you began to get the really kooky internet IPOs. One figure's kind of interesting. In all the 90s up to that point, there had only been seven times when a company went public and doubled on its first day. And then in November and December of 98, it happened seven more times. And then in 99, it happened every third day. So I think the repeated instances of government coming out and bailing out this fiasco or that, of course, in the case of LTCM, there was a government-organized rescue of the fund, I think gave investors a sort of false sense of security that no matter what happened, Uncle Sam would be there. And I think that contributed to the speculation in the late 98 and 99, early 2000.
All right, I'll get off after one.
You want to go after Bob Rubin again? Go ahead.
No, actually, I didn't entirely understand. I got the idea that the strong dollar was about protecting Russia against the deflationary forces. But I'll get off and listen. I wanted to ask about, first of all, what about this theory that LTCM was too big to fail? What does that say about the market? And my other question was this theory that was out around that time that valuations don't matter. You heard a lot about that back then.
Yeah.
In the stocks. So anyway, I'll listen to hang up and listen to what you've got to say.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Those are two good questions. The question about LTCM relates to my second book, When Genius Fails, and the issue being this hedge fund in Connecticut, which was so interlocked in so many markets, the Fed came to feel it was too big to fail, i.e., the consequences would be too serious for the rest of us. I think that was a mistake, and I said so at the time. I think, had markets just run their course, LTCM would have collapsed. There would have been big losses at investment banks, the ones that traded and financed LTCM. But, I think at the end of the day, would markets have ultimately found a bottom? I think yes. Would sanity have crept back to markets? I think yes. And would we still be sitting here today with a capitalist economy and so on? I think also yes. I think when people make very big mistakes, the system works best if they bear the pain from those mistakes. I guess the second question was, what about the idea that value doesn't matter? I hope we learn that it does. If the Nasdaq falling from 5,000 to 2,000 didn't teach people, not to get ahead of the underlying value of stocks, I don't know what would. But value is all you got to. That when I say value, I mean the value based on the underlying business, the cash flow potential, and so on. That is all you're buying. Whatever is based on the trend or what's hot, that can go up in smoke tomorrow. And so, yes, I think value matters.
Seems, though, that's one of those things that's tough for people to leave alone, particularly as things grow and grow. And, if you have a stock that's selling for hundreds of dollars, if somebody somewhere, some analyst says, well, this is really only worth 50, well, but it's selling for 400, and I could have bought it last week at 350, and next week maybe it'll be 425. So
that's true, but what you're saying is, it's selling at a foolish price now, but I'm going to bet on there being a greater fool to buy it for me, and that's why they call it the greater fool theory. Now, sometimes a greater fool will come along, and if one doesn't, the greater fool turns out to be you. I hope not too many of your listeners want to run that risk. That's why we had the crash.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go to, we have somebody here on our toll-free line, I believe, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get an opinion of Warren Buffett. He seems to be able to see through a lot of this shenanigans. Is that really so, or is he just a sharp guy and that's all there is to it?
Well, I mean, when you say is that all there is to it, that's a lot. He has one quality which I think really distinguishes him, and that's an ability to trust his own instincts and not to be influenced by what's trendy or what other smart guys are supposedly doing. In late 2000, this is early 2000, people were saying routinely he'd lost it because, of course, he wasn't in any of the tech stocks, and the stock of his company, Berkshire Hathaway, hit a low, believe it or not, on the very day the NASDAQ peaked. The more people got excited about Yahoo, the less they wanted to be in an old-fashioned company like Berkshire Hathaway. And, today Yahoo's down by, 70-80%, Berkshire has doubled, actually, since then. Buffett, he did it before in the 1960s. He ran a private investment partnership, which today would call a hedge fund. And the 60s were also a period of froth and speculation. They called it the go-go years.
Yeah.
And Buffett was making money hand over fist, but he just didn't trust the market. In 1969, he wrote his investors a letter saying, I don't get it, I'm getting out. He wrote them a check and sent them the money back, and he folded up the fund. He just wouldn't go along with something that seemed out of whack, no matter how many consultants were saying now's the time to get in. In fact, that was the very year the market peaked. It didn't make a new high for about 13 years. So he's a pretty good market timer, too.
How is he doing right now compared to other mutual funds, which they talk about all the time?
He doesn't run a mutual fund. He runs a diversified holding company. In form, it's somewhat like General Electric. It has a great many different businesses. One of those businesses is insurance, and through the insurance company, he owns common stocks. But he owns a lot of businesses. He owns a furniture store and a newspaper and a candy company and so on. So it's important to recognize that the stock won't trade necessarily at the determined value every day like a mutual fund would. And right now, the stock is certainly doing great. I think it hit a new high yesterday, in fact.
That's Berkshire Hathaway.
Berkshire Hathaway.
Yeah.
And I own some of it, just a full disclosure. I don't want you to buy it on my say-so.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Well, one of the things that I think one always hears about Buffett, and he seems to be famous for, is his assertion that he's not going to invest in anything that he doesn't understand. If he can't get it, then he's not going to go there.
That's true, Dave. And if Warren Buffett, this great guru, shies away from stuff he doesn't understand, what the heck are the rest of us doing, going into stuff? There's not one investor in 100 who understood Enron because its books were incomprehensible, but it sure had a lot of fans. It's a very good lesson. I mean, it's akin to saying if you personally don't understand the valuation or the price, don't go in. But Buffett likes to say there are no called strikes in investing, meaning, you don't get penalized for not investing. It's not like baseball where they call a strike on you for leaving the bat on your shoulder. So if you're not certain, if you don't understand it, just look at the next pitch and look at the pitch after that and wait till you get one where you're dead certain.
We have about 10 minutes left, and I guess I'd like to introduce again our guest, Roger Lowenstein. He's a financial writer, has worked for the Wall Street Journal, continues to contribute to the journal. He's now a columnist for Smart Money magazine. And he's the author of several books, including this new one here we're talking about, which is titled Origins of the Crash, the Great Bubble, and Its Undoing. It's about the stock market boom and bust of the 90s. It's published by the Penguin Press. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. If it would be a long-distance call for you, you may use our toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. We're getting some more callers here lined up. I want to ask you quickly a question about Enron, just because recently here, after a long period of time where not very much seemed to be happening with the case.
We have an indictment.
Jeff Skilling has been indicted. He says he didn't do anything wrong and maintains his innocence. Andy Fastow agreed to cooperate with the federal investigative task force and apparently has provided information. The guy who was the chief accounting officer of the company,
Richard Cozzi,
was also charged. So now some of the very top management has been charged. The only guy so far who has escaped is Ken Lay, and there's some question about that. And I guess I wonder whether you think in boardrooms around the country, people are looking at that and saying, and if there has been any malfeasance, they're saying, well, we're going to have to clean up our act because look what happened to these guys. That could happen to us.
I think there's been a very great change in the boardrooms. You know, we spoke earlier about Andy Fastow getting the Enron board to waive the conflict of interest policy so that he could go out and wheel and deal against his own shareholders. You know, I think if a CFO went to a board today and asked for the right to do that, they would throw him out on his ear. Not just because it's wrong, but because no director today wants to be on the board of the next Enron. One reason is that the laws have changed and made it very clear that boards are responsible for the quality and for the integrity of a company's books, of a company's financial disclosure. And secondly, they're just, you know, looking at all these trials. The directors and executives are scared stiff. You know, that nobody wants to be you know, the next Jeff Skilling going on trial, the next Martha Stewart, the next Dennis Kozlowski of Tyco going on trial. So I think, you know, both because some of the requirements have changed and because executives, like the rest of us, read the newspapers, the climate, you know, has become more chastened. Now, you know, will it last? I think, you know, two things happen. One is, you know, over time people forget. And they lose their fear a little as they get more greedy. And the other thing that happens is over time, financial types dream up, you know, new techniques and, you know, what once seemed an ironclad rule of prevention or protection now has developed some loopholes. So, you know, financial integrity is something I think that each generation has to sort of reassert for itself. But, you know, but for the moment, I think, you know, there are more companies reporting honest numbers, certainly, than there were, say, 5 years ago.
We have a number of callers here. We'll try to get them in the time that remains. We'll go next to Champaign County and line two. Hello.
Hi. I heard you on another show just recently, and someone asked the question I was thinking about, which was, and I don't think you really did a persuasive job in answering it, which was...
I hope I can do better.
Okay. We'll give it another shot. He asked, why are you using the past tense? And a lot of things are still indicating that there is still a bubble, priced earnings, so there's still a lot of instrumentalities that are incomprehensible to most people, so we know there's probably still a lot of artificial shenanigans going on. And so basically that. Well, the other thing was Buffett is still like $18,000 a share or something, isn't it? Or
it's is 90, it? Berkshire is at $95,000 a share.
Yeah, so it's not something that...
Your average person is not going to be able to.
Well, there's a cheaper class of stock, which is on the order of $3,000 a share. But that has nothing to do with the attractiveness of the stock. He hasn't split it, so the number's big. But you, as with any stock, you have to look at the earnings behind it.
I guess if you really wanted to, you can analyze what he does and look at his portfolio and do as he does. But actually, getting back to the point, and since there's a little time, I'll just hang up and let the other person on too.
Yeah, the past tense. You know, I'll give the same answer I did before, and hope it persuades some people that you know, there's a difference between a bubble and an overheated stock market, or even a stock market where some prices are too high. And certainly, we had a nice run in 2003, and I'm sure that some stocks are too high. I use the past tense because in the late 90s, it wasn't just a question of stocks being high or even of companies not having earnings. People were saying that earnings didn't matter. People were saying that that was an old economy metric. Remember that one? That in the new economy, we wouldn't need earnings. It wasn't just a bubble of stock prices. It was really a bubble mentality. I mean, people's thinking had become warped. They were leaving, you know, places like the East Coast and Chicago and going out to work for companies that had no revenues and no prospect of revenues because they thought all these old economy companies were going to go out of business. In fact, it was thought to be a bad thing to have hard assets, real assets. I just don't see that type of mentality back yet. You know, we may, as Bernard Baruch says, the stock market's going to fluctuate. And, you know, last year it was up. But I don't think we're back in the late 90s quite yet. And I also don't think you know, whereas in the late 90s, you had companies routinely gaming their earnings. I think disclosures for now are a little better.
All right, let's go to Champaign for the next person here, line three. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Can you kind of clarify what's the deal with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae? And, you know, they hold something like 80-90% of the mortgage loans?
Yeah, well, they hold a tremendous amount of loans, and they get in effect, a subsidized rate on their own borrowing because they have a perceived imprimatur of, you know, the U.S. government standing behind them. And they've been doing some increasingly dicey things with their investments. And so the fear is that, you know, in effect, if they're not well managed, no one really knows what's in their portfolio at every level. They could turn out to be another long-term capital management. That was the hedge fund that we spoke about, which was a bond trading firm. And what bond traders do is they lend money and they borrow money and they try to do it at a spread. And, of course, you want to be lending money at a higher interest rates than you're borrowing it at, right? So you make a spread. But the further out the risk curve you go, you know, the more interest income you may be making, but the more risk you may be taking. And, you know, that is one reason why people are worried about them. And it's also a reason why many people think it's time for the government to say, yeah, you guys are on your own. You really don't need, and it's not the place of the federal government, to give you even an implicit backup or guarantee. And I think that's a good idea.
Thanks.
All right. Well, we're getting, again, really short on time. We'll try to get one more caller here on line one in Crystal Lake. Hello.
Well, I think you're right. The big companies are too big to fail. For instance, a week before the crash, the president was saying that people should buy stocks. And then also a former Treasury Secretary, Thomas O'Neill, also says, buy stocks, and it was on the TV even. So I think they had an inkling that there was a crash coming. And also the big are too big to fail because they, if they lose money, like when United Airlines was losing money, and Enron, the president wanted to give a dozen companies $500,000 in loans, gifts. And, of course, they don't pay them back. He even wanted to rebate the alternative minimum tax. For the last 15 years, the president wanted to give them a rebate because I think he knew the businesses weren't doing so well. The records were falsified, and there was, you know, they said they had asset when it was a debt and things like that. And everybody knows about the Enron scandal, of course. And
yep.
He wanted to give Enron. There was two airlines that were going to get to the back to the alternative minimum tax. We're going to get these tax rebates for the past 15 years, and there were five energy companies.
Yeah, let's get a response from the guest. He raised caller raised a number of questions here.
You know, I just don't subscribe to the idea that companies are too big to fail, and I just that's why I don't like to see the government go in and bail them out. It's very interesting that, you know, the wave of deregulation we had, there was a lot of cheering on the sidelines, but the industries where we've had the greatest amount of deregulation, telecommunications, financial services, energy, you know, what do you know? They turn out to be industries where we've had the worst problems and the biggest scandals. So, you know, maybe that's something to look at before we deregulate further.
We have talked about part of the problem being the fact that so much CEOs, so much of their compensation was either stock or stock options. So it was their interest to run up the price of the stock. Some people have said that that's something that should be addressed. At the very least, we should pass some kind of rule that says if you have the stock and you're an executive, you need to hold it for a specified period of time. So at least you're not going to be able to realize any kind of short-term gains. Is anybody talking about that or anything else?
You know, tremendous idea. No one is talking about it at a serious level. I don't think it can be done by government. I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't know how government tells companies what to pay their employees, including their executives. But, you know, if I was on a board, I would never give an option that could be cashed out in a year or 2 years. I mean, these things should be held for, you know, 10 years minimum. I mean, that is, you know, the idea that we create this race of CEOs supposedly working for long-term shareholders, which yet they have incentive to cash out their stock in a year or two, it's madness. And no, unfortunately, there really haven't been any attitudinal shift on compensation, and boards have to answer to that.
Yeah. Well, I think we're at the point here where we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. I want to thank you, Mr. Lowenstein, very much for talking with us. We appreciate
David, it. David, it was really my pleasure.
Our guest, Roger Lowenstein, and if you're interested in reading his book, again, it's titled Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing. It's published by the Penguin Press. His other books are Buffett, Making of an American Capitalist, and When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management. He's now a columnist for Smart Money magazine and continues to contribute to the New York Times magazine, and the Wall Street Journal. He's traveling around the country talking about his book, and today he is in Chicago.